Hey there, and welcome to the Consultants Council podcast, a place for consulting industry guidance and best practice advisory. Whether you're working to grow in your consulting career, you're managing and developing a consulting firm, you're working with consultants, or you're just interested in business and high-performance advice, we've got recommendations and education for you. I'm Kelsey Kreveling, founder and CEO of Kelsey Consulting, a firm focused on building high-performing organizations, teams, and leaders through a variety of ventures, including the Consultants Council. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology and management consulting, working with organizations across the country to help solve their toughest challenges, while also supporting the growth and development of multiple consulting firms, helping them improve their long-term performance trajectory. In addition, I'm an entrepreneur across a few different industries, and I serve as a startup investor and advisor, promoting the ideas of other entrepreneurs as they work to gain traction in their industries. With so many people gearing up to launch their own businesses and establish their own consulting practices, I want to make available the advice and lessons others and I have learned along the way. This podcast is made possible by Kelsey Consulting. For more information, check out our site at theconsultantscouncil.com and kelsc.consulting. That's kelsey.consulting. Today's episode is sponsored by Tori, a personal physical asset inventory capital manager. Head to inventory.capital to request your invitation because your inventory tells a story and it is safe with Tori. And now stay tuned for this episode's counseling because the consulting world is full of nuances and the answer is always, it depends. What's possible? Do more. Hey there and welcome to this episode of the Consultants Council podcast. I am really excited for this episode. Joining me today is Dr. Petra Illig from Anchorage, Alaska, and she has a really neat career history, but also is the founder of an incredible wellness supplement, adaptogen, tincture. It's pretty cool. So anyways, with that, I'm going to turn it over to her to let her introduce herself and tell us all about it. Dr. Illig.
God, thank you so much, Kelsey. This is so sweet of you. Yeah, I'm a physician, a medical doctor in Anchorage, Alaska. I've been here about 22 years. My day job is doing medical exams for pilots, which involves a lot of things, especially if they have any medical conditions that might be of concern to the FAA. We basically are probably the highest volume of an aviation medical practice, certainly in Alaska, if not in the Pacific Northwest. I have a couple of other physicians that work with me, so we're open full time, but basically we just all day long, see pilots, make sure that they're safe to fly from a health perspective, try to give them advice about how to stay healthy and safe, and talk about airplanes, which we all love to do. And
which is a lot of fun. I do get it. I don't get to fly very often, but when I do, it's a ton of fun. And actually, it was one of those things that when I pursued it, it opened up a whole new world. And it also opened up a lot of just confidence. I don't know that people necessarily realize that going through that process, just it grants a lot of, I think, psychological ability that you wouldn't know going in that it's going to grant. Knowing that you can fly a plane is a neat thing to be able to take on, even if you don't fly regularly. I read something that there's a study that says something like 80% of men think that they can land a plane in the event of an emergency without any flight training. And it's an interesting perspective to have because I do have the confidence that, okay, if something bad were to happen and there was no other pilots on an aircraft, I could put the headset on and talk to flight control and be able to navigate. So it's interesting for sure. So, okay, how did you get involved in that type of a lifestyle and generate that kind of an interest?
Well, I did something really stupid during medical school. I took flying lessons at the same time, which was a really
That's
dumb thing to do. Yeah. Yeah. So my first flight physical is what we call them, of course. Being a student, I had no money, so I looked for the cheapest AME, aviation medical examiner, in Seattle. And this was a physician who basically did his flight physicals out of his home. He was an oncologist, so he didn't have an office where pilots could come to, and he did them out of his house. And so he was like $25, but that was four decades ago, believe me. So I thought, wow, you know, this is really such a neat thing to be able to do, to combine your love of flying with medicine. But I started doing flight physicals just on the side, and I took, you know, a page out of his playbook and actually did them out of a back bedroom, spare bedroom in my house as well. Because once I got out of medical school and internship, I went on to be an emergency medicine physician. And again, in the ER, I didn't have an office in which I could do flight physicals. So I did the same thing he did and carved out a little back bedroom. And at that time, I actually lived at a residential air park near Seattle. And so a lot of times the pilots would fly in, taxi the airplane up to the back of my house. And sometimes I noted that their medical certificate had actually expired. And it's like, dude, you flew this. I'm not going to say anything.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, but that was really a lot of fun because they would just fly in, come get their exams and fly out. And it was just a wonderful way. But it's not a lucrative career. And so I continued as I was raising children and continued being an ER doctor until in 1998, I think it was, I was recruited by Delta Airlines and I switched careers and went then into full-time aerospace or aviation medicine. So that's how I got into aviation medicine, and I've been doing it ever since.
Well, and it's such a specific and unique component mm-hmm. of medical practice. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, there's not that mm-hmm. many practitioners that really choose to specialize in such a unique degree. And I have to think it's interesting, the doctors that come to that form of medicine. I think mm-hmm. many of them, most of them, all have a passion and background in wanting to fly personally. Right. Because as you said, an oncologist was also doing flight exams. It's interesting that lots of different specialties all also then kind of gravitate towards that market.
Well, they're usually pilots themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And so they get it. But you know, most, and I'm going to just use the term AME because that's what we do, aviation medical examiners. Most AMEs really only do maybe 15 or 20 flight physicals a year. Most of them are, you know, have their own busy practices. And so they might only do a handful of flight physicals here and there for their own patients who happen to be pilots. There's very few of us who do it full time. And that gives me an opportunity then to handle complicated cases, because you can imagine if a pilot comes in and he's had heart disease or cancer or diabetes or whatever, that's going to take a lot of additional paperwork and documentation to send to the FAA. An AME only does a handful of them a year. Two things. Number one, they may not have the confidence to know what the FAA is going to want. And number two, they don't know how to charge for this because their practices are built in with insurance payments and insurance doesn't pay for this. Right. So they usually just kind of like walk away from it, tell the pilot, oh, you're going to get a letter from the FAA and they're going to tell you what you need, but not provide that additional assistance. And we don't do that. We do it all. We try to be proactive. For example, if a pilot comes in and says, you know, I had a heart attack 6 months ago, but my doctor says I'm okay. I would tell him, let's be proactive. Let's collect everything that the FAA is going to need because I know exactly what they're going to want. Let's put that package together and be proactive. So you're not going to wait 2 or 3 months before the FAA even tells you what they need. And so we love doing this. And as a matter of fact, a big part of my practice is getting pilots back to flying who are in substance abuse recovery. And that to me is a huge, well, it's a lot of work, but it's just
sure.
a huge service, you know, to the aviation community. So in some respects, I just wrote an article on being an AME of this type. And my first sentence was, nothing is more rewarding, you know, for an AME to get their pilot back to flying after they've been treated for substance abuse. But there's nothing that's less financially rewarding for the time and effort and work you put into it.
Right.
But it's so much fun, you know, and I deal with people who are intelligent and care about their well-being and their health and will listen to what you're advising for them. And it's just a great practice.
Well, and I have to think, as you said, I mean, that's a lot of fun to get to be a part of making
flight possible. I think that's something that people don't realize. I mean, you go and you get your pilot's license, but that doesn't then mean that you are able to fly. Right now, I'm not current. I don't have a current medical. And that medical certificate is what grants you the ability to actually be in the air and gives you your wings. So it's incredibly critical, especially if then you're a commercial pilot and that's how you're making your living, to be able to stay in the air and to be flying. So what a rewarding and neat just aspect of medicine to get to be a part of. You also have some experience within not only the aero aviation space, but also the aerospace beyond what we're doing flying just in you know, just right off the ground, but actually kind of beyond that. Tell us about that too.
Yeah. So I've always had this fantasy of, you know, if I had the money to go up on, you know, a SpaceX flight or something like that. But I've done a lot of training and I work with professional organizations like Civil Aviation Medical Association to help physicians in the community have a better understanding of what a patient of theirs who may want to fly as a space tourist, what might be the medical kind of necessities or requirements for that?
As they go to space, I think that's something that a lot of people haven't likely given a lot of thought to. They like the idea of getting to go to space. They like the idea of getting to be out of this world. And they don't think about the health and wellness implications of how difficult the journey is. Actually, we've had another guest on the show. He's a colleague, friend of mine, Josh Haynes. He has an aerospace company and they're focused on training the next generation of astronauts for that type of more commercial space travel. But it's a fascinating area, I have to think, of medicine.
It sure is. And it's kind of like unknown. I mean, we're learning as we go along. But, you know, you have to really recall that until recently, astronauts were extremely fit individuals. They had gone through lots of centrifuge training. They'd gone through a lot of health exams to make sure that they would be able to, you know, deal with the G forces associated with acceleration and deceleration, weightlessness, etc. And we've learned a tremendous amount from astronauts on the International Space Station and some of the other orbiting stations that occurred before then. But again, these were very fit individuals. But now we're entering an era where it's like an 80-year-old rich guy, you know, who's not going to say no. He's putting his money down. He wants the time of his life. And of course, those are completely different human beings than folks who have been training all their lives for this. And so you also have to take into consideration the length of the flight. Is this just an up and down thing? So that's a totally different set of parameters and circumstances than if you're going to go up orbitally for a few days or even for a longer period of time. So I've been involved in some of the early commercial space travel or commercial space guidelines for space tourists that would be involving different types of flight profiles. Now these space companies, commercial space companies, they basically have their own interior medical departments. So I'm really just peripherally now at this point involved with that because I found other things to do. But again, it is a very fascinating part of aerospace medicine, looking at shifting the focus from people who have been training for this and who have been selected for this and who are, you know, very physically fit, shifting this over to people with a host of medical conditions. What about a person who has diabetes? Are they going to be able to take their insulin injections? Does this get even absorbed properly in weightlessness? We don't even know yet how various medications are metabolized or absorbed in these environments. So there's a lot going on and it's really fascinating. And I just wish I could live another 50 years to see how it turns out.
It is so exciting. And actually, I think in the next, my personal opinion is in the next 10 years, we're going to start to really see the end of aging. I think we're really going to start to see people living just exceptionally longer periods of time. So, you know, that goal of yours might very well come to be. But tell us, so you said, you know, you've been busy with some other things. What are those other things?
Well, the thing that's taken over my life here the last 15 years is the Rhodiola Project. And that is, I've just become consumed and passionate over this because it's really just unfolding in ways that I never would have really imagined 15 years ago. So just a little bit of background on that story. As a physician, I like reading my science magazines. And in, I think it was in about 2008, this article in Science News popped up about this really interesting subarctic herb, a medicinal plant called Rhodiola rosea. And I was fascinated by it, in part because I just didn't know anything about it. And it had this very long history of use in indigenous northern peoples. And being up here in Alaska, that struck a chord with me. And traditionally, a rhodiola root, it's the root that contains the properties, has been used primarily for its ability to improve mental focus and physical stamina. So historically, it was used mostly by athletes and warriors. It was actually considered a Viking warrior secret. So, you know, thinking about this plant now more in modern times, I also learned that it has a lot of health benefits in addition to those two primary effects. These health benefits were investigated very heavily in the Soviet Union and were categorized as an adaptogen. And adaptogens are botanical chemicals that don't really create or produce a specific effect, like you would take a medicine for to lower your blood pressure. Okay, that's a specific effect. Adaptogens are chemicals really that have more of a broad health and wellness and rebalancing effect in that they have a tendency to help improve, regenerate, normalize, balance normal biochemical pathways that are faltering from stress or illness. So a lot of it has to do with the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. People, you know, these axes, this axis was designed, I hate to use that word, but it kind of, anyway, this axis, the purpose of that axis is primarily to create a fight or flight response. In other words, if you're being faced with, you know, a bear in your cave, either you're going to have to shift your physiology so you increase your heart rate, increase your blood flow to your muscles and get things going so you can quickly react either by running away out of the cave or by, you know, beating the bear to death. And then that's supposed to rebalance and renormalize, and the adrenaline is supposed to dissipate. Your adrenal glands are supposed to be able to go back to normal. Your parasympathetic nervous system takes over again and you rebalance everything. Well, that doesn't happen in chronic stress. It's like it's on all the time. And that is not how nature intended. So people basically go through, you know, the negative effects of chronic stress by reducing their cortisol output, their ability for cortisol output in their adrenal glands. The constant stress hormones are inflammatory. They increase risk of heart disease and cancers. And so it's really just bad stuff. And so adaptogens help renormalize that pathway and bring things back into normal conditions. And that's why they're called adaptogens, because they help the body adapt to stress. So I'm reading about this, and I grew up in South Dakota around farmers, and so I always had this little warm spot in my heart for farmers, and I kept thinking, I wonder if we can grow this in Alaska, simply because the rhodiola, the best rhodiola, grows in places that are very similar to our climates in the mountains of Siberia and in Central Asia. Got this idea. I was able to get some seeds and I got this idea to give it a try. And over the course of 2 years, I think it was about 09 and 010, something like that, I put out 100,000 seedlings in my front yard. And they grew. And I thought, oh my God, if I can do this, and I'm sure professional farmers can do this. But then I had a problem. I had 100,000 plants in my front yard that I needed to dispose of. So I started elbowing my way into farm meetings and, you know, Alaska Farm Bureau and the Food Security Council and all these people. And I felt like a total imposter because I'm not a farmer and I'm standing up there telling them about cultivating this. But it slowly gained traction. I got the support from the Cooperative Extension Program at the university. A couple of intrepid farmers thought, okay, well, I'll give it a try. And sure enough, they could grow it and they could grow really good stuff. The trick is to convince the farmers that they're going to make money out of it because that's what it's all about, right? The world only rotates around making money. And so the problem I had was convincing them to do this without having a playbook on how to cultivate it, because this was all kind of like an experiment. Mind you, they had been doing this in Alberta, Canada for a few years prior to my stumbling on this, but they have different soils, they have different conditions than we did. So we kind of had to figure things out on our own. And the other major challenge was to convince the farmers that, you know, to do this for 5 years, because it takes the plant 5 years to mature to a point where it's worth harvesting. And that's kind of hard to tell a farmer, okay, go ahead, work your butt off for 5 years, send your kids out there every summer and do the weeding, and eventually you'll make money, but I don't know how much. So in the meantime, though, the price of rhodiola, raw rhodiola material, has just skyrocketed. And that's because of two things. Number one, people are learning about it. And it's such a beneficial botanical that people are telling everybody about, you know, their friends and their networks. So the demand has increased, but also the supply has significantly decreased because until about 2 years ago, literally the world supply for rhodiola for botanical companies had been coming from wild harvest. Literally, the villagers in Siberia and in the mountains of China, they would take their trucks and they'd go up in the mountains and they'd dig up these plants. And the really painful thing is that in those really harsh conditions where the plant grows naturally, these plants can be decades old because they grow so slowly in these very harsh conditions. They literally grow where no other plants can grow. So they don't. You know, the only predator they have is humans. So when they're uprooted, those plants are killed, right? And the demand has been so high that these supplies have dwindled. And at the end, 2 years ago, I think it was December of 2022, Rhodiola rosea, the wild form, the wild species, has been put on an international endangered species list called CITES. And CITES stands for Convention of International Trade of Endangered Species, Flora and Fauna. And if a plant or an animal is on that list, that species cannot be traded internationally. I mean, you can do whatever you want in your own country, but you can't trade that across to the botanical companies that are going to buy it. So this is huge for us because now the only way botanical companies that aren't directly in Russia or in China have to get cultivated rhodiola, which is good for Alaskan farmers because we're cultivating it. So one of the main things I'm trying to get our Alaska farmers to understand is that this is an opportunity for Alaskan farmers to become the leading edge rhodiola growers on the planet. They're already cultivating Germany, in Poland, and I'm sure in China and Russia, although we're probably not able to get that information, you know, with the current geopolitical issues. But we have an opportunity to really put Alaskan agriculture on the map. In the background of all of this, for me, as, you know, a girl who loves farmers and farming, we have a significant food insecurity situation in Alaska. We don't grow much food. We used to grow a lot more than we do now, but we rely on transportation to bring us our food. And if the transportation industry went down, our store shelves would be empty in a week. And yeah, we hunt and we fish and things like that, but not really commercially. That's subsistence. But we really, our farmers really struggle because they keep growing plants here that are really not, that really are difficult to grow here. We do well with things like potatoes and carrots, but there's only so many potatoes and carrots you can eat, right? But they don't really have, they don't make enough money to support themselves by building greenhouses and tunnels and other ways of extending our very short growing season. So my thought was, if I could give them a crop that actually takes advantage of our harsh growing conditions here, and they can make money off of that, maybe they'll grow more food on the side. So to me, it's a big picture of sustainability, not just for rhodiola, and conserve and save the species from extinction by giving a cultivated, a high quality cultivated crop, but also helping the farmers by giving them a plant that actually, you know, grows here also, very well.
I love that. And they can make money from it. Also, so the product does not have to think hard to transport. I mean, it's not like they're now growing something that's really difficult that has a lot of spoilage or a short shelf life. So I have to think that that really broadens the reach of what you can attain with it too. I mean, that's.
Yeah. Once the root is dried, it's durable. But all along here, I mentioned that there's no handbook on this. I had to do a lot of basic science to figure this out. One of the things I discovered was that by digging up the plant, even though that plant is not going to die, I mean, can I give you a little side story here? So yes, you're right that the it's a durable product, but it has to be handled properly and processed properly. One of the things I discovered was that even though the plant doesn't die, for example, I was really surprised a couple of years ago, I had dug up a root as part of a project and I trimmed it off like I was going to dry it and dehydrate it. I stuck it in the glove box of my RV and I forgot about it. And a year later, I mean, mind you, my RV went through a whole deep winter, right? And then the next spring, I go into the RV and I'm getting it ready for the next summer camping trip. And I open up the glove box and here's this root with shoots growing out of it saying, save me, get me into the ground. And that was a year later. So the plant will, I mean, it's really hard to die, but unless when it's stressed like this, it's consuming those ingredients that we use for our own stress, you know, management. And so I did an experiment to see, to kind of simulate what happens during harvest. Like I said, the plants won't die. A month later, they'll still look, you know, they'll have green shoots and they look like they're well. But I did a test where I took 20 random samples of roots. Half of them I dehydrated, cleaned, washed, sliced, and dehydrated right away. And the others I just let sit outside on my porch for 2 weeks. I mean, they didn't die. They looked fine. And I processed them and I tested them for the rosevins, which are the key ingredient. They had lost 50% of their rosevins in 2 weeks. So then I did another experiment to see how to stop that. And basically refrigerator temperatures stops that degradation. So you're right. There's not spoilage, but let's say a farmer might be, you know, 300 miles away from the processing facility. We need that farmer to refrigerate those roots before, while, you know, during the time it takes to get to the processing facility, because we're really keen on keeping the quality and the potency. And that's not how most botanicals are handled. And so, you know, later on when we talk about some other things like a consumer's choices in choosing a botanical product, you know, there's so much that goes into the quality, the where it originates from, how it's processed, how it's handled, how old that ingredient was before it actually was put into the capsule. I mean, there's so much about that that's really important.
No, I think it's really exciting to hear, first and foremost, just the background of the project, the fact that there is an adaptogen out there that can make such a fundamental difference. I can personally attest to its effects. I've been using it now for several months through some of the most strenuous and challenging times of my personal life. And I
can absolutely attest to just how clear I feel mentally, how capable mm-hmm. I feel. My physical endurance is significantly better. I'm able to work out harder and longer in the gym without feeling fatigued. Mm-hmm. It's really shocking and impressive how great it's been able to create an impact. Because I think so many things that you take don't necessarily
right.
make much of a difference. So to actually feel and see it is powerful. But that goes into what you're doing is making sure that it is such a high quality ingredient, because I think there's so many products on the market that just don't hit that mark, that are not full potency, that are not clean and healthy and considerately harvested and grown and brought to market.
Well, you bring up, a big problem in our herbal supplement and dietary supplement industry, because it's not regulated. In Germany, you buy something off the shelf, you know that what's on the label is exactly what's in there. And here, you're taking a risk. You're kind of like relying on the reputation of the brand. But I would say that if you took a bunch of rhodiola products off the shelf and sent them for testing, most of them are not going to be the potency or possibly even the species or even have any rhodiola in it, because there's no regulatory agency doing the testing, like with food. You know, food, of course, there's a lot of testing going on, even though it's not a perfect world. Things do escape, you know, the regulators. And that's why we're just so keen on doing it right. And we can do it right because we're small enough that our team is small enough and dedicated enough, you know, so that eyeballs are on, you know, every step of the way. And then when I finally figured out, you know, how to help growers grow this in a successful way, initially I was basically connecting them to buyers, because I didn't have I had no idea how to make tincture. I mean, it's a simple thing. I just probably overthought it, but I was connecting buyers to the growers. And after a couple of years of this, I did a little math and I realized that those buyers were making about 10 times the amount of their investment in the product by simply making tinctures and capsules. And so I decided to keep that money in Alaska, because in Alaska, we have a tendency to extract and ship. We don't do a lot of manufacturing here, whether it's oil or whether it's fish or whether what, you know, we don't make stuff. And so I turned my living room into a little research facility, and I spent a couple of years perfecting my tincture formulation. It took quite a lot of doing and testing and sending to lab and trying it back and forth. And I finally hit upon the formulation we're using now. And I mean, can you imagine coming over for dinner at my house and I had a 30-ton hydraulic press in my living room? So anyway, I made that formulation. I got it out locally. And like you, I had a lot of people telling me how much it helped them and how impressed they were in comparison to rhodiola products that they had tried previously. And so that motivated me. And then with the help of my very talented daughter on social media, you know, our sales took off. And so we got the manufacturing facility out of my living room and built one on the Kenai Peninsula. It's not in Anchorage. It's in 200 miles away at Anchor Point, where one of our growers, who's my business partner, put together this very, very beautiful manufacturing facility. And we have like two gals that do this every day, and they've gotten so good at it, and they're so passionate about it, that it's just really a joy to see them. We bought scaled up operations. I used to make the tincture with a turkey baster, you know, filling it with the turkey baster. Now we have a little equipment that sends it around on a little conveyor belt, and it fills it and it put the cap on it and then sends it to the labeling machine. It's just really fun to see that. So we're able to now keep up with the demand. And then we did so well last year. We sold, I think last year it was about 40,000 orders, which was, I mean, it was stunning. We went from, we thought selling 10 in a day was like a big day. And then the social media part that my daughter had been working on for several months took off. And I'll tell you a funny story about that. She and I were in Nuremberg, Germany, a year ago in February at a organic food trade show. And I had had a friend fulfill our orders while we were gone because we were only doing 4 or 5 or 6 orders a day, maybe 10 on a big day. And at that time, I had a ping on my phone every time we had an order because I didn't want to miss them. And so we're having lunch in this beautiful old, you know, 12th century restaurant in Germany. And my phone starts pinging, like it wouldn't stop pinging. And I'm like, what's going on? By the time we got back from Germany, we were 2,000 orders behind.
Your friend, oh my goodness, she didn't know what she was signing up for.
It was crazy. And so then I scrambled because I came back, you know, I have a day job. I have to go to the office every day. And so at night I would be packaging up and I called all my friends and I said, please, I'll buy you all the pizza and beer you can eat and I'll give you $20 an hour and just come over and help me. So they'd come over for a couple of hours here and there and we'd fill their cars, you know, with packages and they'd take them to the post office. But, you know, I was able to pull together a nice little team. I have 2 Ukrainian sisters who do my fulfillment. They do it every day. And then a former secretary became my customer service agent. And so we've got a really tight little team now. But I'll tell you, that was like, oh my God, what have I done?
You were not using the scale that quickly.
I was not. And I mean, last year was amazing. And so with the money we made, we're now building an extraction facility. So my next product is going to be a capsule in a specific uniform standardized dose. You know, tinctures are beautiful because they pull out a large spectrum of ingredients. You know, if you use water for the water soluble components, an alcohol, ethanol for the organic, the components that are not easily dissolved in water, they can be easily dissolved in an organic solvent like ethanol. You can pull out a lot of those important ingredients. But tinctures is, you know, it's good stuff, but it's not an exact dosage science. Like, it's kind of like hippie medicine, you know, you put a few squirts into your coffee or your tea. Measure with your heart and your effect, right? Mm-hmm. But most clinicians would want to know, you know, would want to give a precise dose to a patient to see how they do on that. And with tinctures, it's a little bit difficult. So we're building an extraction facility, should be up and running in about 2 months, where we take our tincture, distill off the ethanol, distill off the water, and get it down to a dry powdered extract. And then we can test each batch and make sure that we know how much of the marker ingredient, which is called Roseven's, is in each capsule so we can standardize that. And I'm really, really, really excited about this, but I'm also a little scared because it's a ton of money and nobody in Alaska has done this. I've hired a really smart young chemist and she's, you know, working at this and I'm just crossing my fingers that it'll work out because otherwise, I don't know, I'll never be able to retire. I'll have to work the rest of my life.
Oh, I trust it's going to work out. It's, I mean, like I said, I've never found another product that has had such a drastic impact for the positive so quickly and mm-hmm. provided such just clarity and focus and resolve. That's kind of the only way I can think to describe it. Okay, so I'm curious, on that day when y'all were in Germany, had y'all run maybe an ad or was there anything in particular that you can pinpoint drove that increase in immediate traffic?
Well, I never even asked my daughter about that specific. I think it was just, you know, it's weird. It's how it works into an algorithm of sorts. You know, it's algorithm driven. And if you miss that mark, you're just not going to get in there. And somehow the magic came together, the music of the spheres came together, I don't know. And it just went wild. As a matter of fact, Lena was laughing, my daughter was laughing. She had put one little TikTok video out last week of me just filling a bottle. Can you imagine that? Me just in the counter, in the kitchen counter, filling a bottle. And she said something, and I was filling this for a friend who was having some downtime, some difficulties. And this little TikTok video of me just putting a couple of squirts into a bottle, and she said, hey, this is for a friend in trouble, 400,000 views in a week. It's like, what? How does that happen?
Oh my goodness. Well, I need your daughter's social media skill and help. Oh my gosh, because it's very difficult to break through the algorithms and generate traction and views. And they call it feeding the algorithm.
Yeah, but you know what? If the product wasn't so good, it wouldn't work. You know, it's because somebody tried it and they tell 10 friends, right? And social media allows for that, you know, and the only reason this sort of thing works is because the product is good and people like it.
Which is just, it's so exciting. Okay. So building a new extraction facility, what other big goals do you have for this project?
Well, once we get to a dry powdered extract, we can make all kinds of products, right? We can make capsules is the first one that comes to mind. Other things we can make is like put it in packets where people can maybe put it in their sports drink. But my big interest in the future is skincare. Rhodiola is very popular in Russia for skincare. For a couple of different areas. Number one, for women over 40, because it helps reduce wrinkles and has anti-aging effects. And there's also benefits for injured skin. So, you know, like balms and, you know, instead of putting an antibiotic ointment on, you might put a rhodiola ointment on there. That's a whole area that I have very little knowledge about in skincare. So when we get to that point, I'll be looking for, you know, a company that would like to work with us. But the beauty about skincare is that you can really stretch the amount of rhodiola that you have. And that's another topic I'd like to cover here in a moment. Because when you take rhodiola internally, you've got a big tank, your body, and you have to have enough rhodiola in there to get to all of those nooks and crannies, right? But on skincare, you only need parts per million, because you're putting it on a very small area. So it would help us, as long as our harvests are still rather small, it would help us stretch what we have. Skincare is really where I'd really like to get to in the near future.
Well, I mean, skincare has much higher margins as well. I mean, people are willing to spend so much when it comes to what they put on their face. Yep. I can see there's probably a ceiling on what people are going to pay for a tincture or for a supplement.
Right, right. But that brings me to the next big challenge we have. And that challenge is getting more growers. I'm running around. I feel like I'm like the Johnny Appleseed of rhodiola. I'm running around, you know, trying to convince people, put this in the ground. I swear it's going to, you know, you're going to have some financial reward from this. First of all, Alaskan farmers are pretty darn independent thinkers. They want to figure it out themselves. You know, nobody's going to tell me what to do, right? They want to figure it out themselves. And the other challenge is that we don't really know all of the best soil amendment situations. Rhodiola will grow just about in the crappiest soil on the planet. But farmers don't want to just grow little, you know, tiny rhodiola plants. They want plants that are big enough and potent enough to be economically viable for themselves. So we're kind of like trying to, and there's no playbook on this. So we kind of listen to people in Canada. I've got friends in Poland who are growing it, who have some of their ideas. We also have a wonderful gentleman here, Carl Edwards, I call him our citizen scientist. He's a retired high school science teacher, and his wife passed away from Huntington's disease a few years ago, and he was giving her rhodiola, and it helped her. It doesn't cure the disease, of course, but it helped her with her mood and her energy. So after she passed, he thought, well, I'm going to look into this and see if I can help grow bigger, more potent, robust plants. And he's developed a high-pressure aeroponic technique that so far looks like he can produce a plant in 3 months that's the size and potency of a two-year-old plant. We're also looking at other ways of jump-starting in a greenhouse. What we're trying to do is shorten the time in the field without compromising quality. And unfortunately, ag research takes years to resolve because you have to wait for the plant to grow.
Right.
Yep. So with this and listening to other farmers who are kind of trying their own little experiments, I'm convinced that in the next handful of years, we will have a good idea on how to do this, you know, very well in Alaska, what soil amendments, what things in the greenhouse, you know, all those sorts of things will come together. As a matter of fact, I'm looking for a sponsor. I'm looking for a way to put together an international rhodiola conference in Alaska and bring in people from Germany, from Finland, from Scandinavia, from Poland, from all these other places that are growing rhodiola so that we can learn from each other. Because there's no rhodiola trade organization. There's no, you know, society. I wish we could learn from the Russians because they have the most background and knowledge. But in today's geopolitical climate, that's probably
not
going to happen right away.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they won't be able to come to a meeting like this. But the point is we need to learn. So my big push right now is to get more growers involved. Otherwise, we're just going to stay a little tiny cottage industry, only making 100,000 tincture bottles a year and not being able to, you know, progress on a larger scale.
Well, in effect, the change that you know is possible with this product. And I have to think, though, maybe similarly to the cannabis industry, they've done so much research on how do we grow and how do we cross-pollinate and how do we hybridize and how do we make this more effective or intense? And to a certain point, does that then really change the end result and the experience for the user? And so that's, I'll be really curious to see how the efforts that y'all are pursuing, does it result in better outcomes for the people taking the product, or does it actually then change and maybe generate other outcomes that are not as desirable?
So you are really smart. You hit the nail on the head here because the whole idea about why do these plants make these anti-stress chemicals? It's because they're stressed, right? They live at 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 feet elevation, you know, in Central Asia, in the Himalaya Mountains, on the peaks of the Altai Mountains in Siberia. You know, they struggle and they exert a lot of energy to make these compounds so that they can survive these harsh climates and not die, you know, in the frozen tundra in the middle of the winter. What happens if we take these plants now to a slightly more mild climate? I mean, we're still Alaska, but we're not as harsh as up on the tops of the Altai Mountains. And now we're babying them. We're giving them fertilizer. We're weeding them and all of that. Is this going to produce lower quality? We don't know this. So there's that. So we're on the lookout to make sure we always test the Rosevin and Solidricide, which are the two marker compounds in every harvest, and cross our fingers that we're not creating kind of a lower quality plant simply because we're babying it. And that's a concern, a long range concern.
Right. Well, and given how wonderful it is at creating mental clarity and acuity and focus and just endurance, I wonder then if it is not as stressed of a plant, would it create less rigorous results for the individual? Would it maybe embody them with more desire for comfort, right? Who knows? It would be interesting to see what the results.
It's all, you know, evolution is an interesting, you know, process, isn't it? And anytime you stir the pot, you know, something else happens. You know, but the point is, if we can keep, you know, a rhodiola in as harsh a conditions that people can comfortably farm in, that should be very, that should work. The other concern we have about is global warming. Will our farmers have to move further north? Is the Kenai Peninsula, where our best growers are right now, going to be able to grow other vegetables that were not able to be grown? 10 years from now, will we have a warmer climate where you can grow other vegetables, but maybe it won't be as good as for rhodiola? Maybe the rhodiola farms will have to move further north. So, you know, life is always full of all kinds of challenges and surprises, and this is going to be one of them. But I'm at this point now, 15 years into this project, confident that rhodiola is an established crop. It's still pretty small, but it's here, and I'm confident it's just going to keep growing simply because the demand is there. But yeah, there are all those kinds of like problems, potential problems. I wish our university system was more involved in this. Unfortunately, Alaska's run into a lot of economic problems because we base our state finances on the price of oil. We have no income tax, and we have no state sales tax. So when the price of oil goes down, we really struggle financially. So the university has shrunk down significantly. And I'm just hoping that they will recognize the need for doing rhodiola ag research, because I, as one person, there's only so much I can do, right? I've done now 8 years of ag research with various research plots. One of them now is in my front yard, but it's just me. And this has the potential to keep students in agriculture or horticulture in Alaska busy for decades, because there's so many questions about creating a pure seed stock, a robust seed stock, creating cultivars and tissue cultures, checking for, we're going to see plant infections. We have, fortunately, a plant pathologist at UAF, University of Alaska Fairbanks, who's very interested in rhodiola infections. We haven't really seen any out in the fields yet, but it's just a matter of time. And so there's so much to be able to, for the university to be able to be involved with, to promote this agricultural endeavor. And I just hope that they will see that, recognize it, and get funding for it before I can't be pulling weeds out of my yard anymore.
Well, I think the steps you're taking to create that international group can really lay that foundation for a framework that can go and grow beyond you.
Yeah, I'm hoping for that.
Okay, so as now a physician and an entrepreneur, any advice you have for those that might want to follow in those footsteps?
I would say what kept me going was confidence and faith. So I've done other projects in my life that didn't work out simply because it was the wrong thing at the wrong time. And you know, you'd run into a challenge and you'd think, I'm just going to power through this and make it happen. See those kinds of resistances that are not fruitful. Maybe that's not the right plan. But with rhodiola, it was sort of like, it was the right plant at the right time. Everything kind of, not saying it wasn't a lot of work. It was a huge amount of work. It's been a huge amount of work, but it was an organic process. It just seemed to be the right thing at the right time. And so for me, I would say just keep sticking to your principles and don't give up. And have confidence. That's what got me through so far.
I love that. Well, Dr. Illig, thank you for your time today. This has been a lot of fun, very educational as well. I'm just really excited for what you've been doing. And it always seems like, oh, it's an overnight success. And then you hear, you know what? Yeah, it's an overnight success that took 10, 15 years to become an overnight success. But you've hit that point of critical mass where people are hearing about what you're working on, they're enjoying the product, reaping the benefits of it. And it's really exciting now to see how it's going to evolve in the market and to make a difference for so many people. I'm excited for it to move into skincare and to some of the other applications. I didn't realize that you could even use it in skincare. So now mm-hmm. I'm I'm tuned into that. I'm curious as to what that might result in and what that might look like.
Well, I thank you so much. If I may, I just want to mention the three goals that I have here. Goal number one is to put money in the pockets of Alaskan farmers. That has to be goal number one. They struggle. They work very hard. They don't make much money. And here's a crop for them that actually would work very well if they just put their energy into it. So goal number one, put money into the pockets of farmers. We need more food grown here. Number two is I want to produce the highest quality cultivated rhodiola on the planet. It has to be good. It has to be pure. We're not cutting any corners anywhere. And number three, I would like to build a whole infrastructure of a business infrastructure in Alaska that goes from the field, from the farm field to the store shelf. None of this shipping out to other companies we call outside with a capital O. Outside is everything outside of Alaska for them to take advantage of us. So we want to keep this in Alaska for the benefit of Alaska and create jobs. So those are my three goals, and maybe make a little money on the side.
Yeah, I love that. That's really awesome. I worked for a company that had a slogan of do good, have fun, make money. And they added the have money part at the end because, well, if they didn't, they could not continue to do the other two parts. So I think what you're pursuing is just, it's really exciting. And I think it has a fundamental ability to make a profound difference for people. So for anyone listening, I would highly encourage you to check out the Alaska Rhodiola and enjoy the benefits it has to offer. Well, Dr. Illig, thank you so much for your time today, for being a guest and for sharing your experiences, knowledge, and your venture with all of us listening.
Thank you, Kelsey. Appreciate it.
And that's a wrap on this episode of the Consultants Council. Thank you so much for your interest and engagement. Let us know what you'd like to learn more about by writing in to info@theconsultantscouncil.com. Thanks to Kelsey Consulting for facilitating this podcast. And thanks to Tori for sponsoring this episode. To learn more about how Tori can manage your personal physical assets, head to inventory.capital. And with that, cheers and all my best. Have a great week. And remember, what's possible? Do more.